That evening, in reply to Larkin's bellowed queries, I replied, "Thanks, Peter, we're fine. No, 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 we don't need anything. Yes. Yes, good. Well, please tell Mr. Stuyvesant there's no change here, nothing to report." I switched off the set and avoided Sally's eyes. "Yes," she told me sternly. "After a stinking one like that, you should look guilty." "Well, you said yourself it's only one bead and a piece of bone." But by the evening, 2 days later, I had no such excuse, for I'd sunk my trench 7 feet 5 inches, and there I uncovered the first of 4 courses of dry-packed masonry. The stones were skillfully dressed and squared. The joints between each block were so tight that a knife blade wouldn't go between them. The stones were bigger than those of Zimbabwe, clearly intended to support the weight of a substantial edifice. The average size was approximately 4 feet by 2 by 2. They were cut from red sandstone, similar to that of the cliffs, and as I examined the workmanship, I knew beyond any doubt that they were the work of artisans from a powerful and wealthy civilization. That night I spoke to Larkin again. "How soon can you get a message through to Mr. Stuyvesant, Peter?"
"Should have gone back from New York today. I can put a phone call through this evening."
"Well, please ask him to come right away."
"You mean you want him to drop everything and come running? That's a laugh. Just do it, please."
The helicopter arrived at 3 o'clock the following afternoon, and I ran to meet it, pulling on my shirt.
"What have you got for me, Ben?"
Lurin demanded as he climbed, big and blonde, out of the cabin.
"I think you're going to like it," I told him, as we shook hands.
5 hours later, we sat round the fire, and Lurin smiled over the rim of his glass at me.
"You were right, lad. I do like it."
This was the first opinion he'd expressed since his arrival. He had followed Sal and me from excavation to cavern to clifftop, listening attentively to our explanations, shaking his head with a rueful grin when I explained our theory of low-angle light on the ruins, firing a question occasionally in the same tone I'd heard him use in a director's meeting. Each time the question was relevant, incisive, and searching, as though he were evaluating a business deal. When Sally spoke, he stood close to her, looking frankly into her face, those marvellous classical features of his rapt and still. Once she touched his arm to enforce a point, and they smiled at each other. I was happy to see them so friendly at last, for they were the two people in the world I loved. He knelt with me in the bottom of the trench and caressed the worked stone with his hands. He held the charred bone and melted glass bead in his palm and frowned at them as though trying to draw their secrets from them by sheer force of concentration. Just before sunset, at Lurin's insistence, we returned to the cavern and went to the rear wall. I lit one of the gas lanterns and placed it so that its light fell full on the painting of the White King. Then the three of us sat around in a semicircle and studied it in every detail. The king's head was in profile, and Sally pointed out the features, the long straight nose and the high forehead. "A face like that never came out of Africa," she said. And as a contrast, she picked out the painting of another figure further down the wall. "Look at that. That's a Bantu, and no mistaking it. The artist was skilled enough to differentiate between the features of each type." However, Lauren's attention never wavered from his scrutiny of the king. Again, he seemed to be trying to wrest its secrets from it. But the king was regally aloof, and at last Lurin sighed and stood up. He was about to turn away when his glance dropped to the white-robed priest figures below the king.
"What are those?" he asked.
"We named them the priests," I told him. "But Sally feels they could be Arab traders or..." "That figure in the center," he pointed out the central priest figure, and his voice was sharp, almost alarmed. "What's he doing?" "Bowing to the king," Sally suggested. "Even though he's bowing, he stands taller than the others," Lorin protested. "Size," was the bushman's artist way of showing importance. "See the relative size of the king. Although they're pygmies, they always show themselves as giants. The size of the central priest would signify that he was the high priest, or the leader of the Arabs, if Sally's right. If he's bowing, it's with the top third of his body only, and he's the only one doing it. The others are erect." Lorin was still not convinced. "It's almost as though..." And then his voice trailed away, and he shook his head. And then suddenly he shivered briefly, and I saw the goose flesh appear on the smooth, tanned skin of his upper arm. "It's become cold in here," he said, folding his arms across his chest. I hadn't noticed any drop in temperature, but I stood up also. "Let's get back to camp," Lorin said. And it was only after I'd built up the fire to a cheerfully crackling, spark-flying blaze that he spoke again. "You're right, lad. I do like it." And he took a swallow of the malt whiskey. "Now, let's start talking prices," he suggested.
"Set it out for us, Lo."
I agreed. "I'll negotiate with the Botswana government. I can put a little leverage on them. We'll have to have a formal agreement drawn up, probably split any fines 50-50. They'll have to guarantee us access and exclusive rights, that sort of thing." "Good. That's certainly your bag of tricks, Lo. Knowing you, Benjamin, you have a list of your requirements, the men you want, equipment, am I right?" I laughed and unbuttoned my top pocket. "As a matter of fact," I admitted, as I handed him three foolscap sheets. He glanced over them quickly. "Oh, very Spartan, Ben," he congratulated me. "But I think we can get in a bit bigger than this. I'll want at least a rough landing strip here to start with, something to handle a Dakota. The hot weather's coming. You'll die living out under canvas. We'll need solid accommodation. Also office and storage space with the air conditioning. And that means a generator for lighting and to pump water down from the pool." "No one can ever accuse you of being half-assed, Lo," I told him, and we all laughed. Sally refilled my glass. I was jubilant and mightily pleased with myself that evening. I had much to be proud of, ferreting out a secret so well hidden for millennia, and Lorin was going to back me all the way, partner. The whiskey went down my throat like water. I used to drink a lot of whiskey. It was a way of forgetting certain things and making others easier to accept. And then about 6 years ago, I found I hadn't worked on a book for a year, that my memory and intellect were blurry and unreliable, and my hands shook in the morning. I still drink a tot or two of an evening, and occasionally I take on a full blast of the stuff. But now I drink because I'm happy, not because I'm sad. "Come on, Ben. Come on, tonight we've got something to celebrate." Sally laughed and poured me another heavy portion. "Wow! Gently, Doctor," I protested weakly. But that night I got drunk. Pleasantly, contentedly, floating drunk. With dignity I refused Lorin's offer of assistance and made my own way to the tent wherein Sally had discreetly segregated me since Lorin's arrival. I fell on top of my bed fully clothed and went to sleep. I half woke when Lorin came in and climbed into his bed across the tent. I remember opening one eye and seeing the glow of the waning moon through the fly of the tent. Or was it the first glow of dawn? It didn't seem important then. The personnel for the project was the most important consideration, and here I was lucky. Peter Wilcox was due for his sabbatical leave from Cape Town University. I flew down to see him and in 6 hours convinced him that he wouldn't enjoy the flesh pots of Europe at all. Heather, his wife, was a little harder to sway until I showed her the photographs of the White King. Like Sally, rock art is one of her big things. They were good people to have on a dig, We'd been together on the excavation of the Slangkop caves. They were both in their 30s. He, a little paunchy and balding, with steel-rimmed spectacles and trousers always on the point of falling down. He had to keep tugging at the waistband. She was thin and angular, with a wide, laughing mouth and a snub, heavily freckled nose. They were childless, cheerful, knowledgeable and hard-working. Peter plays a very jazzy accordion, and Heather has a voice that harmonizes well with mine. Peter introduced me to two of his postgraduate students, whom he recommended without reservation. I was startled at my first meeting with them. Ral Davidson was a young man of 21, although the fact that he was a man was not immediately obvious. However, Peter assured me that beneath all the untidy hair lurked a promising young archaeologist. His fiancée was an intense, bespectacled young woman who had graduated at the head of her year. Although she was depressingly plain, and I prefer my women beautiful, Leslie Johns endeared herself to me immediately by whispering breathlessly, "Dr. Kazin, I think your book Ancient Africa is the most exciting thing I've ever read." This display of good taste secured the job for them. Peter Larkin found me 46 African labourers from the southern territories of Botswana, who had never heard of the Hill of Blood, nor of any curse upon them. My only disappointment was with Timothy Magiba. I spent 5 days at the Institute in Johannesburg on my way back from Cape Town, mostly trying to convince Timothy that I needed him at the Hills of Blood.
"Mahani," he said, "there's work here that no one else can do."
I was to remember those words later.
"Where you are going, there is work that many men are capable of. You have these men and women already, specialists, all of them. You do not need me."
"Please, Timothy, it would be for 6 months or so. Your work here can wait." He shook his head vehemently, but I hurried on. "Look, I really want you and need you. There are things that you alone can explain, Timothy. There are over 15,000 square feet of paintings on the rocks, and much of it is simple, stylized emblems which only you..."
"Dr. Kazin, you could send me copies of them. I can still give you my interpretation."
Timothy switched to English, which with him was always a discouraging sign.
"I hope you don't insist that I leave the Institute now. My assistants cannot work without my direction."
We stared at each other for a few seconds. It was a deadlock. I could order him to come, but an unwilling helper is worse than none at all. There was a rebellious, independent spirit smouldering in Timothy's dark eyes, and I knew that there was some deeper reason why he refused to accompany me. "Is it?" I hesitated. I was about to ask him if the ancient curse was the reason for his refusal. It was always disquieting to find superstition influencing an intelligent and well-educated man. I was reluctant to come straight out with it, for even with an African like Timothy, the direct question is considered gauche and discourteous.
"There are always reasons within reasons, Doctor. Please believe me when I tell you, it would be better if I did not accompany you this time."
"All right, Timothy," I agreed with resignation and stood up. Again we locked glances, and it seemed to me that he was different. The flickering fires burnt brighter, and again I felt the stirring of unease, even of fear, deep within me.
"I promise you, Doctor, that my work here is at a critical stage."
"I will be very interested to see it when you're ready, Timothy." My four new assistants arrived on the commercial flight from Cape Town the following morning, and we drove directly to the Stuyvesant hangar where the Dakota transport was waiting. The flight in was noisy and gay. Peter had his accordion along, and I never travel without my old guitar. We hit a couple of easy ones like Abdul, the Bulbul Emir, Green Grow the Rushes O, and I discovered with delight that Ral Davidson whistled with a clarity and purity that was truly beautiful, and that Leslie had a sweet little soprano. "When we've finished this dig, I'm going to take you lot on tour," I told them, and began teaching them some of my own compositions. It was 3 weeks since I'd left the Hills of Blood, and as we circled it, I could see the changes that had taken place in my absence. The landing strip, complete with windsock, had been gouged out of the dusty plain. Near it stood a cluster of prefabricated buildings. One long central bungalow with the residential quarters grouped around it. A skeletal metal tower supported a 2,000-gallon galvanized iron water tank, and beyond that was the encampment which housed the African labor force. Sally was waiting for us at the landing strip, and we piled our luggage into the Land Rover and went to look at our new home. I expected Loren to be there, but Sally told me he'd gone the previous day, after a stay of a few days. Proudly, Sally showed us over the camp. The central air-conditioned bungalow was divided into a small common room and lounge at the one end. In the center was a large office, and beyond that, a storage warehouse. There were four residential huts, air-conditioned but sparsely furnished. Sally had allotted one to the Wilcoxes, one for Leslie and herself, one for Ral and me, and the fourth for Loren or other visitors, pilots, and overnight guests. "I could think of a few improvements in the sleeping arrangements," I muttered bitterly. "Poor Ben," Sally smiled cruelly. "Civilization has caught up with you. And by the way, I hope you remembered to bring your bathing costume. No skinny dips in the pool any more." And perversely, I regretted all that Loren had done for me. The Hills of Blood were no longer a lonely, mysterious place in the wilderness, but a bustling little community, with aircraft landing regularly, Land Rovers kicking up the dust, and even the clatter of an electric water pump, shattering the dreaming silence of the cavern and disturbing the still, green waters of the Emerald Pool. Quickly, my group settled into their allotted tasks. Sally worked on at the cavern with a single young African assistant. Each of the other four was placed in charge of a team of 10 laborers and assigned an area in which to work. Peter and Heather shrewdly elected to work outside the main walls in the ruins of the lower city. It was here that the ancients would have disposed of their rubbish, broken pottery, old weapons, discarded beads, and the fascinating debris of a vanished civilization. Ral and Leslie, with dreams of gold and treasure, jumped at the chance of excavating within the enclosure, an area which the ancients would have kept swept, scrupulously clean, and therefore much less likely to yield finds of interest. That's the difference between experience and inexperience, between the impetuosity of youth and the cool calculations of an older head. I kept myself free on a supervisory and advisory capacity, spending my time at those places where it could do the most good. Anxiously, I watched Ral and Leslie to assure myself that their approach and technique was satisfactory, and then I relaxed as Peter Wilcox's recommendation proved correct. They were clever, enthusiastic youngsters, and more important, they knew their way around an archaeological dig. The four teams shook themselves out as the dullards among the African laborers were sorted from the bright ones. In a shorter time than I'd hoped for, the firm of Kazin and Company was breaking ground and doing good business. It was slow, painstaking, and thoroughly satisfying work. Each evening, before the nightly sing-song in the common room, the day's work was discussed and any discoveries evaluated and related to their place in the general picture of the site. The first conclusive discovery was made that the ash layer at level one persisted throughout the site, even in the lower city. It was by no means evenly distributed, but showed up in patches of varying thickness. Carbon dating, however, gave a fairly constant result, and we settled at a date of AD 450. This date seemed to be concurrent, or to slightly predate, the oldest Bushman paintings in the cavern. We were agreed that Bushman occupation of the cavern would have followed immediately after the departure or disappearance of the ancients from the city. Scrupulously, we referred to the first occupations as ancients, considering the term Phoenician as yet unproven, a condition which it was my most dearly held hope would soon be altered. Associated with the ash lair were haunting scraps of human remains. Ral uncovered an incisor in the ash against the base of the main tower. Peter, a complete humerus, together with many other unidentifiable bone fragments. These unburied human remains went a long way to ensuring a general acceptance of my theory of a violent end to the City of the Moon. This was reinforced by the baffling disappearance of walls and towers, which we could reasonably accept once stood on these bases of clay, with their vestigial stone foundations which occurred spasmodically along the outline of the temple enclosure.